This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Evan Wasuka. Civil society groups have hit out at a proposal to force detainees to pay for their detention costs in Australia.
This policy is gratuitously cruel. The overwhelming majority of people who are deported or removed from Australia on character grounds are people who are living in poverty, and there's no way known that they're going to be able to pay this money.
Papua New Guinea police and military are on high alert in Engam province as tribal violence flares up again.
Police and military must work overtime to make sure that peace must prevail and children must go to school.
And we find out why this song has changed the life of one Pacific artist. But first, public outcries against police violence in Fiji are gaining heat after a forceful arrest of a local bus driver. A video posted on social media shows a police officer pulling forcefully on the driver's head and the man saying he cannot breathe. The officer in question has been suspended from duties while an internal investigation is conducted. But as Marion Farr reports, the Fiji Law Society alleges the use of unnecessary force by the police is becoming all too frequent.
Captured on video, a police officer is seen yanking the neck of a young bus driver multiple times. The officer stops and the bus driver is heard saying, "I can't breathe." The alleged incident happened on Monday at a bus stop in the town of Labasa on the island of Vanualevu. Fijian MP Lenora Gerengeretabua from the National Federation Party witnessed the incident.
I saw this police officer trying to pull a driver out of his seat by a handcuff, which was by then attached to the driver's left wrist. Passengers who were sitting in the bus were gesturing and shouting, and I saw a student standing by the door recording or videoing the incident on mobile phones.
The driver, 30-year-old Elvin Manny, was seated in the bus when it's understood the police officer stepped on board and asked for his name. When the situation escalated, Ms. Gerengeretabua asked the officer to stop.
Excuse me, I'm a member of parliament. You cannot do that.
I'm telling you nicely to come out.
I said to him, look, you can't do that to him. You can't do that to him.
She says what took place was deeply disturbing.
When times are so hard right now in Fiji, we've been through so much violence as a country, way too much. And to have an officer who has sworn to protect the people behaving in such a manner is just not acceptable, not acceptable at all.
Elvin Manny was taken into custody and charged with seriously assaulting a police officer and failing to give his name and address. The officer in question has now been suspended from his duties pending an internal investigation into his conduct. Monday's events have sparked a public outcry in Fiji, with footage of the arrest shared more than 2,000 times on social media. Mr. Manny's sister, Shelen Manny, says the family has been traumatised.
I am shaken. I am very shaken. It is very disturbing to see what my brother has been going through. All my mother is saying that she has lost the trust in the Fiji police force and she cannot ever believe and trust the Fiji police force ever again.
Ms. Manny says she's asked police for a report into her brother's medical condition, but the request was refused. The ABC has contacted Fiji police for comment but received no response. Ms. Manny says she's deeply concerned about her brother's well-being after a brief conversation with him on the phone yesterday morning.
My mother asked him, "How are you?" The only thing with heavy-hearted, he said, "I'm not well."
President of the Fiji Law Society, Wiley Clark, says while Monday's events were shocking, it's not an isolated case.
What we're seeing is this sort of disproportionate force being used to effect arrests is becoming more and more sort of prevalent. Rather than it being the sort of last step, it's become almost sort of the first response.
And Mr. Clark says that's concerning.
not only does it undermine public trust, but I think it also erodes the rule of law, because rule of law requires the respect for people's, you know, for human rights and people's right to question authority and to raise legitimate questions about why they are being detained.
The Law Society president believes more should be done to address what he alleges to be systemic issues within Fiji's police force.
And I think it really then requires, we think, a closer look at the training that these police officers are receiving, and also the leadership within the police force sending a clearer message that they must use their powers in a sort of more sort of restrained way.
Fiji Law Society, Wiley Clark, ending that report by Marion Farr. And local media are reporting that Elvin Mani was released on bail after appearing in the Lambasa Magistrates Court yesterday. Civil society groups in the Pacific and human rights lawyers have united to condemn an Australian government proposal that would see detainees who are being held pending deportation being charged hundreds of dollars a day for their stay in immigration detention. If the coalition government is re-elected on Saturday, it has pledged to start billing anyone waiting to be expelled on character grounds, particularly convicted criminals who are not Australian citizens. And as Dubravka Volodya reports, it's a move that would affect a disproportionate number of Pacific Islanders.
They are known as 501s, non-citizens who have committed crimes in Australia and can be deported to their country of birth on what the current government calls character grounds. And now, if it wins this weekend's election, that same coalition government wants to charge 501s for their stay in immigration detention.
This policy is gratuitously cruel.
Professor Patrick Kazier is a human rights lawyer from the Australian Catholic University in Melbourne.
The overwhelming majority of people who are deported or removed from Australia on character grounds are people who are living in poverty, and there's no way known that they're going to be able to pay this money.
The cost for their upkeep would be more than $450 Australian dollars per day. The Australian Department of Home Affairs says from December 2014 to January 2022, 116 Pacific Islanders were removed from Australia. And with the recent commitment to strengthen the so-called character test, that number could increase. In 2009, the then government scrapped a similar scheme after it found the cost of chasing deportees for debts outweighed the money paid. And critics agree any similar strategy would be difficult to manage.
Unless there are assets in Australia, the person, it's going to be very difficult to pursue them for recovery. The administrative costs tend to outweigh the possible benefit to Australia in pursuing the costs, so it rarely happens.
Hannah Dickinson is the principal solicitor at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre.
If a person has assets in Australia, my understanding is that the government has said they'll seize people's assets in Australia to pay this debt. This punishes children and families in Australia, not the people who have been detained. It is crushing. So people in detention are going to be afraid for their families, and they'll end up leaving and not challenging the decisions that they should have and not exercising their rights.
The Department of Home Affairs says Australia has deported 3,349 people under Section 501 between 2014 and the end of last year. The policy has been a sticking point for the New Zealand government in particular. Ms. Dickinson again.
1,700 New Zealanders have been removed after a Section 501 cancellation since 2014.
It's unclear how many of them are Pacific Island New Zealanders since they are not listed separately. Tonga has also had people deported. One of those in touch with deportees in the kingdom is Ofa Gutenbai Likiliki from the Tongan Women's and Children's Crisis Centre. She says the policy would harm communities in Tonga and Australia.
If they are in some kind of paid employment, it would not be anywhere near what it would be expected of them to pay for that 400 plus per day. Now, what that means is that payment will be transferred to their family, and that, you know, that's a burden placed upon their families.
She says it could also drive people underground to offset their debt. But Australia's incumbent Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, has said the policy would send a strong message. And the opposition Labour Party's Christina Kunili has posted a tweet saying that her party supports cost recovery from people in immigration detention.
Dubravka Volodya reporting there. As we count down to Australia's federal election on Saturday, the ABC will be providing wide coverage right up to polling and also vote counting. And you can catch all that on television across the Pacific on ABC Australia. On Thursday night, there'll be a Q&A election special at 10:55 p.m. PNG time. And on Friday, 7:30 program, we'll have an Australia Votes special. And then on Saturday night, there'll also be the latest from the polling results. So lots there to look forward to over the weekend, all on ABC Australia.
Pacific Beat.
Police and military in Papua New Guinea's province of Enga are on high alert following a spate of violence in the highland region. Several people were killed in ongoing clashes, and on Monday, a school dormitory was set on fire by students. Provincial Police Commander Chief Superintendent Efnes Nii says the violence has been contained, but he's warning of swift action if the upcoming national elections are disturbed.
We got a limited manpower on the ground, could not contain the situation, and the Nomali and the Yela tribe took advantage, and they pursue each other in a bloody gun battle, and then a lot of properties and lives lost. Upon hearing that report, on the same day, I requested Enga provincial government if they could assist me financially so that I can hire vehicles and send in a mobile squad pipe from Agen Islands Mobile Group to Pogra to contain the situation. Enga provincial government, through the leadership of Grand Chief Peter Ipatos and his administrator, Dr. Samson Amian, successfully agreed and assisted me by hiring pipe vehicles and providing allowance for my police mobile squad pipe from Agen. And my commissioner also assisted me by sending military to assist and take full control of the area, and situation was under control. From that time to now, the township is all under the control of police and the military. They all work successfully as per my operation order, conducting of a random roadblock to make sure that no parents or men with evil mind to move in to cause destruction. So Pogona is under control as I'm speaking now. And hopefully, once it is done, we will talk with the district law and order, provincial law and order. We also had a meeting previously that we want the normalcy to prevail immediately. And it is my appeal that children must go to school, health workers must return back to work, government workers must return back to work, because we got enough manpower underground to assist them. And it is my directive that police and military must work overtime to make sure that peace must prevail, and children must go to school in a peaceful, without fear or intimidation or anything of that matter.
BBC Nili, the president of the Chamber of Commerce in Pogera, has appealed for the national government to immediately ask for people to surrender their guns, especially that the national election is coming up soon. Is that a bit too late, or what are your thoughts on this?
It's not too late. It's not too late because of this new amendment in the Firearms Act for whoever is in possession of firearm, and once a police or military catch them in possession of firearm, it is now a different story because the penalty version is life-year imprisonment. And this is the message we are giving to all the people in Enga province, and Pogera is no exception. So that is why the Chamber of Commerce in Pogera, and I also concur with them, that the firearms, whoever is in possession of unlicensed firearm, regardless of homemade or factory-made, high-powered or low-powered, all must be brought to police. So it is my call also, as the PPC is called, to the people of Enga province. So I believe it is not too late.
Are you concerned about the issue of law and order during the coming elections, with the number of firearms which could be used to intimidate voters?
It is a concern for all PPCs throughout Papua New Guinea as well. You know, we believe that firearms can be used because of previous experience in previous elections. Firearms were used, visibly seen. And we are making a lot of awareness to do away with the firearms. So we believe that if we send skeleton police officers to all the polling booths, well, police will not do anything much to contain the high-powered firearms in all parts of Enga province if they happen to choose firearm. But, you know, it is our call to the people not to bring in their firearms to polling booths or in campaign rallies or anything, because it is also warning to them that I have enough manpower on the ground, and whoever has evil mind to jeopardize election in my province better think twice, because police and military will not come easy on you, right? So there's a new law in place. They are there to effect immediate arrest upon you, whoever is in possession of firearm or want evil thoughts to bring destruction to the polling booths.
Enga Provincial Police Commander, Chief Superintendent Efenes Nili, speaking there to the ABC's Caroline Tiriman.
Hold the front page!
It's time for the latest news from around the Pacific, and joining us this morning is Faith Makale. Faith, good morning to you.
Good morning, Evan, and good morning to everyone listening.
Great to have you here, and let's head off to New Zealand, where plans on fast-tracking residency for migrants is being criticised. What's happening there?
Yes, New Zealand is planning on fast-tracking residency for migrants, but it is now under fire for leaving out lower income-generating migrants. The fast-track policy focuses on 85 occupations, from psychiatrists to plumbers, in particular workers who earn more than twice the median wage, Radio New Zealand reports. But it doesn't guarantee residency for minimum wage migrant workers, many of which are Pacific Islanders. And Green Party spokesperson for immigration, Ricardo Menendez March, said the policy was discriminatory and that he is disappointed that many workers are being left out.
Definitely an important issue there, and let's see how things work out with New Zealand's immigration policies. Now shifting over to Vanuatu, where first arrests have been made under Cyber Crimes Act, and but some in the media say media freedom is at risk. Tell us more.
Yeah, so four people have been arrested, including a Facebook page administrator and moderator under the Cyber Crimes Act. But because of this, media freedom and freedom of speech in the country has come under scrutiny. The moderators of the Facebook pages were arrested under the charges of cyber libel, cyber slander, and cyber stalking, Daily Post reports. And one of the arrested moderators, Whitnall Tor, says that they are concerned about what the new law means for investigative journalism. Meanwhile, of the Vanuatu Media Association president, Stevenson Liu, shares that he is not too concerned about the Cyber Crimes Act, because if information is verified and factual, journalists would find no trouble.
Yes, interesting times over there in Vanuatu. I'm sure media all across the Pacific will be keeping a close eye and see what comes out of those cases and when they go before the courts. And now over to Samoa, where they're gearing up to celebrate World Bee Day.
Yeah, so the Samoa Women's Association of Growers, or SWAG for short, is gearing up to mark World Bee Day that is happening this Friday, May 20th, which they also hope to raise awareness on the critical role of pollinators. And the day, designated by the United Nations in 2017, is a global call to action for environmentalists, farmers, and beekeepers alike. And so SWAG will be holding a virtual event with the team Bee Engage, Build Back Better for Bees, which will call for global cooperation and solidarity to counter the threats posed by the COVID-19 pandemic to food security and agricultural livelihoods, alongside prioritizing environmental regeneration and pollinator protection.
World Bee Day, a day I'm sure that the honey lovers and bee lovers across the Pacific can look forward to. Faith Makale, thank you very much for bringing us the latest from the region.
Thank you for having me.
Join me, Hilda Wayne, for Sisters Let's
Great.
Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
One of the main challenges that would prevent women from breastfeeding is the inability to keep up with work requirements and to maintain or sustain a paying job just so that they can effectively breastfeed.
For me, it was really challenging. People would give me that look of disappointment when I'm feeding my child with a bottle instead of breast milk.
Mothers have no choice because they have to go to work and they can't leave the babies crying, so they have to swap for formula when they are away.
So join me, Hilda Wayne, for Sisters Let's Talk, Wednesdays at 3:30 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Documents seen by the ABC reveal public servants have found it difficult to provide the Australian government with frank advice about how to prepare for climate change. Part of the reason's been the coalition government's internal conflict on the issue. It's a revelation that's contained in sworn testimony from a public servant during a legal stash with the ABC. National Environment reporter Michael Slezak has more.
Joelle Gerges is a climate scientist at ANU, and even she's shocked at how extreme some of the climate changes are.
The sorts of things we might have expected by the middle of the century are actually happening right now.
As a resident of the Northern Rivers region of New South Wales, she's had first-hand experience of this year's record flooding.
These records are not only being broken, but they're just being completely obliterated. For me, it is really quite confronting to realise that we are witnessing the escalation of these weather and climate extremes in our lifetime.
So she's particularly concerned to hear a senior public servant had argued that a series of scenarios used by government departments to prepare for major disruptions caused by climate change should be kept secret because of how contested the issue is within government. The testimony was made before the Ministry of Appeals Tribunal in July last year by a Deputy Secretary of the Department of Industry, Science, Energy and Resources. They worked with a now-defunct group called the Secretary's Group on Climate Risk, which wargamed possible extreme weather scenarios, which the tribunal has ruled should be kept secret. The senior public servant was arguing to stop the release of information about the group's work to the ABC, telling the tribunal the subject was, quote, difficult for the government to grapple with, and also, therefore, difficult for the senior public servants that are involved in it to grapple with, end quote. They highlighted a disagreement between Prime Minister Scott Morrison and his deputy Barnaby Joyce over the commitment to net zero emissions by 2050, saying it made it hard for the public service to provide advice. The revelation has intrigued Cheryl Durrant, a member of the Climate Council who was previously Director of Preparedness and Mobilisation at the Department of Defence.
It's sort of another piece of evidence that suggests that the public service has become highly politicised and thus unable to do its job of giving frank and fearless advice to government.
And she thinks it's important for the public to be informed.
We always hear about the silent Australians, and we don't have our most informed, our well-informed voices in the public service able to enter the public debate. And I think that weakens democracy in Australia and basically is treating the public with contempt.
A spokesperson for the Morrison government says the coalition's position on climate change is clear, with a firm commitment to net zero by 2050, adding the Morrison government has worked closely with departments in formulating and implementing strategies.
That report by Michael Slezak and Penny Timms. Now, I'd like to introduce you to Kalani Regis, a Chamorro woman from the Marianas whose love for the ocean runs deep. At 30 years old, she's accomplished a lot, from her research work on Micronesian coral reefs and fisheries to being a youth advocate at the Our Oceans Conference in Palau this year. She's also launched Deep Pacific, a podcast with a vision to connect people across the world. Kalani joins me on the show this morning. Hafaadai, Kalani.
Half a day, Evan. Hello, everyone.
Hey, hello.
I appreciate this opportunity.
Excellent. Look, let's start. Where does your love for the ocean come from?
Yeah, of course. My love for the ocean really began where I'm hoping it will end, on my home islands in the Marianas. So it came from mainly my family first, and then my career second. So my father and mother are both fisher people and they love going to the ocean every weekend. If they can get to church first, then they deserve it. And so we would accompany them as kids every weekend to church and then to the beach afterwards for some family time.
And is the ocean still a big part of your life through your profession and away from work?
Yes, I think many Pacific people, perhaps including Australia as well, our lives are centered on the ocean. I think about the ocean every day. I did begin Deep Pacific, the podcast, with that in mind because that love is so strong.
And your cultural connection to the ocean, was that something that was always there or was that something that developed over time, your connection to the ocean?
My cultural connection to the ocean is something that I am still cultivating today. So it was a lot of family time, like I mentioned, when I was younger. And then even without my career or education, I branched out and learned a little bit more about the ocean from the scientific point of view. And then FESPAC in 2016 occurred. And then that connection was much more strong. It was strengthened seeing all these other people and diverse cultures of the Pacific all gathered in one place to celebrate our connections. And many of them navigated to Guam in 2016 as well. So there was that other avenue for using the ocean that I was, I opened my eyes to.
And was the university, being in university, was that a big part of your life in your how you deal with the ocean and the connections there?
It was. I actually came to the ocean in university from my marine science background, and I began with internships. I interned on my home island before college, and then when I went to university, I managed to get into a few fellowships, volunteer opportunities, as well as work in various capacities for the ocean. I like to joke that I've been everything. I've been a coral reef nursery assistant, a fisheries biosampling technician, a underwater diver, and a husbandry assistant. So kind of a diverse range there, as well as research.
Kalani, when we talk about Micronesian indigenous stewardship of the ocean, what does that look like for you?
That's a beautiful question. Micronesian or indigenous stewardship for the ocean looks like intentional co-governance, really. It's empowering the community to take stewardship into their own hands and to give them the tools to meaningfully include their voice when it comes to stewardship and decisions in stewardship. I witnessed that recently on my the Our Ocean conference in Palau. That was where I got exposed to another part of Micronesia's stewardship, which was just groundbreaking. It was life-changing.
If you're listening to Pacific Beat, I'm Evan Wasuka, and my guest this morning is Kalani Regis, a Chamorro scientist and podcast host. Now, Kalani, during the pandemic, you started the Deep Pacific podcast, which explores topics like religion, family, and colonization. You're now launching season two. How was that experience of launching the podcast, and what's the impact? What impact have you seen from it?
Yeah, I think launching the podcast in 2020, many people didn't realize how long I had been nursing this idea. I had been nursing this idea since 2017, really, when podcasts were a way for me to feel connected without needing to do that work of holding up my end of the conversation, you know? So I sought out Pacific Podcasts. I typed in Pacific Podcasts, Ocean Podcasts, and very few shows popped up and returned to me. So I saw that as a space for change and opportunity. And I've built this community of change makers from that idea. And because it was born out of these ideas, many other Pacific people who also want that space to connect to home without needing to necessarily connect to social media have engaged with the podcast. And currently we are at 15,000 listens, and we have a regular subscriber base, as well as people who constantly reach out. I read the reviews of the podcast, actually, of course. And it just gave me such a sense of relief to see people's reviews saying things like, finally, a podcast that represents me, or I feel seen, you know. So I think if 15,000 people say they feel seen, that it's a success. And I think that it has accomplished its purpose.
And what's your plans with season two of the podcast? What should we be expecting to hear on the podcast coming up?
Season two of the podcast will be talking about large topics still. So season one kind of delved into Pacific values and all of these more ground setting topics. Season two will talk about climate change, gender, Pacific leadership, youth activism, and such. So I'm looking forward to it so much.
Now, Kalani, earlier this year, you took part in the Our Oceans Conference in Palau. You've described it as groundbreaking. What was that experience like, and having your voice as part of that conference and such a big platform? We had John Kerry there, the climate envoy from the US. What was that experience like for you?
The way Palau elevated the youth of the 7th Our Ocean Conference was really the first time it's been done that way. And so for me, I really give the nation of Palau thanks for setting yet another great example of Indigenous Pacific leadership, because youth were integrated into the conference for the first time from the planning stages, mainly because some of the people helping to organize the conference are Palauan youth. So being my video submission, for example, to apply as a delegate, I mentioned that this conference specifically, as well as many other ocean-related conferences, needs diverse stories to be told. Stories with winding paths, kind of like mine. And little did I know that I would actually be asked to share my story to the largest audience I've ever had at one time, I suppose. So it was very nice to be elevated to that cause and position.
Kalani,
and I think it sets a great example too for future.
Kalani, you've got your podcast there, you've got your advocacy work. What should we be expecting next from you for the rest, with your plans for the rest of the year?
I think, so right now I'm just trying to continue this trend of social innovation and change in my life. I would love to continue to brush up on research and other ocean-related skills, because I do have kind of a good amount of those, but I could use more. You know, there's always more to learn. And so that's maybe what people could be expecting from me. Besides launching season two of Deep Pacific, collaborating more, I've also been trying to work on youth podcasting workshops so that other youth voices can be heard in addition to mine.
Kalani, thank you so much for joining us this morning on Pacific Beat.
Thank you so much, Evan. Saina Maasi to everyone who listened in. I appreciate this opportunity so much.
That was Kalani Regis, podcaster and marine scientist, speaking to me there. Is there a song or a musical artist that changed your life? For Pacifica artist Sarah Carroll, that song was Katy Perry's I Kissed a Girl. That song started Sarah's obsession with Katy Perry, which saw her go to meet the singer three times, but also ended up costing her thousands of dollars. Sarah's new show called Cherry Charts Her Journey with the artist, and as our reporter Jordan Fennell found out, it helped her to find out where she belonged.
I grew up a lot between Australia and Fiji, so I kind of was struggling to find my place in the world, like with moving around a lot. So I guess back in 2008, I was 13, so just starting that awkward like high school age. Can admit I was very awkward in high school, like not cool at all, not cool. So yeah, it wasn't pretty. And I guess I was kind of just really lonely, and I found an escape in watching music videos. And so one day, I remember watching Rage, and Katy Perry's I Kissed a Girl came on, and there was something that I still can't quite articulate to this day about what exactly it was, but there was something about her that I just latched onto and was like, that's what I want to be when I grow up. Like, there's something about her that's pulling me in. And yeah, the rest is history. I kind of just became very obsessive. And a fangirl. But yeah, she definitely grew up with me and taught me a lot of things that I just wasn't having in my reality. I kissed a girl, I liked it.
Describe for me what your obsession with Katy Perry looked like.
So I've definitely been there since every single album. So I have every album imaginable. When she came to Sydney, so I met her three times. First time was at a hotel that I knew she was staying at. The second time was a surprise meet and greet at a radio station. I had no idea I was meeting her. Yeah. And the third time, my friend wanted meet and greet and took me. Her last tour, I went to 5 shows. If she ever did a tour in Sydney, I went to every single show. I'm in her Prismatic World Tour movie. I make a little cameo and just all the things, and just spent a lot of money on merch, obviously.
Yeah. And what was it like the first time you got to meet her?
The first time was really quick. It was, I just remember, like, there was a bunch of us and she stepped out of this van and I was like pushed by the paparazzi, and I just remember like being face to face, and I kind of was just like, thank you, like that's all I said. And then she hugged me, and then I was like pushed away by the paparazzi who were like trying to get in. The second time I definitely got to like talk to her a little more and thank her. And yeah, it's kind of a crazy thing to meet your idol, because it's still to this day quite a surreal experience. And I feel very lucky that I get to meet my idol, but yeah, it's a bit wild.
And you were saying before that perhaps back then in high school, people viewed you as, you know, like you'd said, the crazy Katy Perry fan.
Yeah.
Or feeling alone. But did you ever find, because I'm assuming that there are also many other young girls who are also really, really into Katy Perry, were you able to find any community in other Katy Perry fans, or not really?
Yeah, so it's actually something I explore in this show, where it is this juxtaposition of being quite lonely at school and not having a place, but finding, because also the show is set in the beginning of that internet era when Twitter was like still quite new. So I did find a community of called Katy Cats online, and they became my closest friends. And eventually I connected with the Australian community who, yeah, every single of those concerts, except for the first time I went, California Dreams Tour, I went with my mom because I was too young. But other shows, I did go with those people, and I mean, some of them are still my closest friends today, which is actually insane. And it was that time where it was like, you know, you would just like go meet up at a concert and be like, oh, you're so-and-so from Twitter. And it was such a normal thing. Because you're hot and you're cold. Yes, then you're no. You're in, then you're out. You're up, then you're down. You're wrong when it's right. It's black and it's white. We fight, we break up. We kiss, we make up. Your show is about your journey in becoming a confident bisexual woman. How did Katy Perry and her song I Kissed a Girl give you an avenue to explore that? Yeah, I think that journey, for sure, I think that song definitely later on in my life became an anthem that I definitely looked up to. I mean, I do acknowledge that it is quite problematic now with some of the lyrics, but I think at the time it was, I don't think I knew it at the time when I was watching her. It was more of like a hindsight thing where I was like, oh no, like I actually was looking at Katy Perry and going, I want to kiss her. Like, that's so fascinating. And then later in life kind of going, oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. She really did help me with that. So yeah, even now, like, I Kissed a Girl takes it back, and it is a song that is just always going to be quite personal for me.
One of the big discussions that's been happening for women recently is about how in decades past, the things that girls were obsessed with, whether it was like reality TV or the Backstreet Boys, were considered silly by men. And these days that we're coming into an era where women have reclaimed that and are saying that we're allowed to love whatever we want and that that should be respected. What are your reflections on that sentiment and how that fits in with your show and how you personally fit into that?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting question. I kind of love that. Yeah, it's really interesting because I think with this show, it took me I spent my whole teen years idolizing, and this was like my life. And I think I definitely, you know, felt a lot of shame about it because people were always like, oh, like she's that weird Katy Perry fan. And so there is a lot of like, I guess, weird like stigma and stuff around it. But I think at the end of the day, like now that I'm kind of proud of myself, like I don't regret anything that I did. Like, I mean, look, I spent $2,000 on like concert tickets. I followed her around Australia. I've met her a few times and I don't regret that. I think like she taught me lots of things that, you know, I just didn't have in my reality at that time, and like was kind of, as cheesy as it sounds, was like a big sister that I didn't have. And I think that can resonate with a lot of young people, especially when I did the show before. I had people come up to me and be like, oh, I felt so seen, and you know, it wasn't through Katy Perry, but maybe they idolized like Taylor Swift or Lady Gaga and they had that similar experience. So I think people are definitely talking about it more and like kind of being like, oh, I do relate to that, which is really exciting for me because I thought I was alone the whole time, being like, no one else is like me. So yeah, it's very exciting. I'm gonna get your heart racing in my skin.
That song is Teenage Dream by Katy Perry and Pacifica artist Sarah Carroll speaking there to reporter Jordan Fennell.
Pacific Beat.
And that brings us to the end of the show for this Wednesday morning. Join us again tomorrow when Nick Fogarty will be hosting the program. You can hear the latest this afternoon at 3 p.m. with Richard Ewitt. Thank you for listening. I'm Evan Wasuka.